Well, welcome everyone. Glad to have you here.
Riley's going on the scavenger.
I usually do something with, I'm Roy Hammerling. I'm from Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. I live in Fargo, across the river. It's an actual place. There are people from there, my wife and I, and a few others. Two others. They were in the movie, we weren't. They didn't survive, we did. One of the things that I've been the chair of the religion department, just stepped down there, and one of the things that we've been trying to figure out how to do with students is try to figure out a way to deal with ideas of centering and how do we keep the busyness of the world kind of outside the class and how do we transition. So one thing that we've been trying a little bit, I would like to do with you, and that is we call these things kind of like mindfulness moments. So it doesn't happen in all the religion classes, but a few of us as instructors have been trying this. So I'd like to do it for just like a minute or so. I'd just like to have a moment of quiet. And in that moment of quiet, you'll notice that your mind is going a lot of different places. And maybe you just want to imagine that those thoughts are like clouds, you know. You can just watch them go by, or you know, you push them by, whatever you want to do. I'll leave a moment of silence, but the idea is to kind of center yourself, just kind of, you can use the time as prayer. We have students that are not Christians, so we say, you know, whatever you want to do in that moment of silence, you can do. And then at the end of that, I'm going to read a few quotes to kind of focus our thoughts. And then after I'm done with these quotes, then we'll start the presentation. Plus, this usually scares students that come in late because everybody's quiet and annoying. So let's take a moment of just silence to be mindful. Can you, O Job, fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits and wonders of the Almighty? Think of us in this way, said Paul. We are servants and stewards of the mystery of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that they should be found trustworthy. Go and contemplate God's wonders. Become lost to yourself in the mystery and the majesty and the awe that is God. When the one who beholds the wonders of God abandons pride and egoism on account of God's work, they will know their proper place and be silent before their Creator. Rumi. Well, welcome. First of all, wanted to thank Paul and Susan for inviting me to come and speak this week at Holden. I'm really thrilled to be here. My wife is here. My wife was here 40 years ago. I've never been in this area. I grew up kind of, I know this area well, but I grew up not too far from here, but I always went to different camps and never got up to Holden. So I've always wanted to, and this is a dream come true for us. Just a little bit about myself so that you kind of know where I'm coming from, and give you a little bit of a background to what the talk is about. I grew up in Odessa, Washington, which is about an hour away from Wenatchee. Small farming rural community, bunch of German Russians. We still had German worship services. I was afraid that I would have to learn the catechism in German when I got to that age, you know, which we still spoke, had some German services for a while. I eventually went on to Pacific Lutheran University, where I got a triple major in religion, philosophy, and classical languages. And I was encouraged to go on to graduate school by my professors there. I went on to Wartburg Theological Seminary, really worked as a TA with Ralph Query, the church historian there, and then went to a parish in Williston, North Dakota, which is kind of in the corner by Canada and Montana. Was there for 5 years and then went to the University of Notre Dame, where I wound up getting my PhD in early medieval and Reformation church history. At Concordia College, my first job when I got out in 1992, I became the resident Luther scholar and church historian, and that's kind of what I've done for all of these years. One of the things, I teach a variety of courses, one of which is on C.S. Lewis, and I'm always struck by one thing that Lewis talks about. Lewis says in the modern world, we have what he calls modern snobbery. It doesn't matter what time it is, you always have modern snobbery. And it works like this. We're the smartest generation that ever lived, right? And in some ways, that's true. We know a lot more about science. We know a lot more about medicine. And so Lewis says the problem is that we think that this sort of mechanical wisdom that we have translates into an understanding about the human condition. And Lewis says, as a result, we often do not go back to the early church fathers, to the scriptures, like Fred took us back today so enlighteningly earlier on today. We don't go back to the word of these ancient wisdom authors and don't learn about ourselves when we could learn a great deal from them by just looking back at these texts. And so what I'd like to do, I'm going to take us back and talk a little bit about this topic, which is the theme for the week, the Mysterium Tremendum. I left it in the Latin because you kind of can read it easily. The word tremendum is kind of ambiguous in the Latin. It means tremendous, wondrous, terrible, terrifying. And I want to have all of those meanings involved in the conversation. And the mysterium is also an ambiguous word, but it really means the great mystery. And of course, what that is we're going to unpack this week a little bit. So in order to set this up, set up the week, I'm going to basically talk about definitions today. And then on tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the mystery of nature. Following day on the mystery of community. And then I'm going to talk about the mystery of suffering. And then end on joy. I didn't want to end on suffering. I wanted to go on something happy. So we'll kind of talk about that. But I think there's some other areas that we'll talk about briefly in a minute. So how do we get around the modern snobbery, and how do we try to understand who we are? Sometimes it's helpful to go back in history and look at times like what Fred did with the time of the kings in Israel. I'd like to just go back for 100 years right now, just to the turn of the late 19th century, early 20th century, and think about the context of that day for just a minute. It was an interesting time. Darwin had published his Origin of the Species, and a man by the name of John Scopes, a Tennessee teacher, decides that he's going to teach Darwin's theory in school. And so in 1925, they have the famous Scopes, what's called monkey trials. And there was this remarkable tension at the turn of the century between science and religion. And people were trying to understand how we fit into the world. We all want a narrative, a worldview of understanding who we are and how our place fits. And there seemed to be at that time this tension between what we might consider science and religion. The tension hasn't gone away. We still see it quite frequently. All you have to do is look into the news, look into politics. I'll just say words and you'll see the tension. Global warming, creationism. business? How do these things play themselves out in the modern world? And they become political issues. They become, you believe in global warming or climate change, depending upon your worldview or your political point of view. And so there becomes these tensions. The tensions could be spoken about in a different way. We could call that the tension between tradition and, say, modernism. We often hear at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, there was a tension between technology and the traditional way of life. Entire groups like the Amish resisted the move from the traditional world, horse and buggy, to the new modern world of technology, simply because they believed that the technology that they were encountering, the telephone, had removed them from the person that they were talking to. They wanted to talk to them directly. They didn't want to be separated. Of course, we know better. Texting and all that sort of stuff has connected us with people. No, we really haven't done that. And so we're struggling with that sort of thing. And we have an Amish community close by where we are, and we like buying their furniture. We like being around them. And I look at them, and I sometimes wonder, we look at them and say, well, that's kind of a crazy life. But I'm not so sure anymore. There is this sort of tension between technology and tradition. And sometimes, I'm completely hooked into the new world. I can't really get out of it. Computers, smartphones, all these sorts of things. I need and want them. But there's something about, even our stories start reflecting this. At the turn of the 20th century, we had stories like Frankenstein, right? And why did we have the story of Frankenstein? Because technology was something that people were afraid of. And it might become a monster in our world and change us in a way that we don't want to be changed. And even our modern movies of late, I'll refer to movies a lot. I teach a religion and film class. I have a son who is a filmmaker in Hollywood. He basically does what he calls social documentary films. And I help him out with that a lot. So I teach a class on religion and film. It's a way for me to connect with him. But if you look at some of our trends in films, we have movies like Terminator, right? And we worry about, there's a recent big film out this summer, Prometheus. One of the characters is an android. And we worry about becoming so technology fit that we're going to lose our humanity, right? And so there's always a tension within different societies between tradition and modernism. And this manifests itself in the late 19th, early 20th century in a dialogue between what was considered conservative versus liberal sorts of theologies, and it manifests itself in political worlds. Political parties will develop platforms based on family values and traditions, right? Versus that party that's progressive, all right? And we see some of these sorts of tensions. So why do I want to go back to that time? Well, there was a writer at that time who was interested in the study of mysticism. His name was Friedrich von Hegel. His last name is H-U-Umlaut-G-E-L, Friedrich von Hegel. And von Hegel, right at the same time, I'll tell you a little bit about him. He was a Roman Catholic from Austria. He was a lay scholar, a Christian theologian. And he saw the problem or the tensions between science and religion, tradition and modernism. He said, we're just much too concerned about the differences. We need to find a way to think about a worldview that helps us understand who we are in a way that helps us move into the modern world, but also is cautious about the problems that certain things can have. So in 1925, Hegel died, and he was buried in the English countryside. He wound up living in England towards the end of his life and writing in English. He wrote on his tombstone, it reads, "Whom have I but thee?" Very nice sentiment. Well, Hugel said, how do we get around the tensions? How do we understand the tensions that are in our society? I think the same tensions are here today. And I use this image with students to try to get them to dialogue. I found that over 20 years at Concordia, even in the Midwest, I find it'd be interesting to ask Fred and others who teach regularly, I find that the political climate is being drawn into the classroom. And sometimes I can't get students to get beyond yelling at each other. I say, you know, why are you trying to verbally throttle your neighbor, you know, with words? Because they have just difference of opinion. So sometimes it helps to think about it in this way. Hugel said, now he was a scholar, and he wrote a book called The Mystical Element of Religion. And it was written in 1908. And it's a great, big, massive thing, almost impossible to find. You can find it in rare book rooms for expensive money. But he says, basically lays out this idea. He says there's three elements to any valid religious group. And the first element is what he calls institutional. And we heard a lot about this morning with Fred when he was talking about the people of Israel trying to figure out how to organize themselves. Do they organize themselves as a people of the covenant who just worship in Jerusalem, or are they going to worship everywhere, or how do we think of ourselves institutionally? You have to organize yourself. And the institution, said Hugel, is very based on tradition. So the values and attitudes of the institution of the religion are a way of organizing ourselves in the world. So let me give you an illustration. Do we have any Roman Catholics in the room at all?
Any what?
Roman Catholics? I was just wondering.
Okay,
so, but none of you are Roman Catholics. So, but I'll ask you this question. What's the name of the Pope?
Benedict.
Okay, who's the last Pope?
John Paul.
Anybody know John Paul II? Anybody know the one that's before him? John Paul I, yes. So, okay, let me, how many of you are Lutheran? Basically most of everybody, okay. Who's the presiding bishop? Who was the last one before him? How about him before him? Getting a little bit more difficult, right? George Anderson. But it's getting harder for you, right? Who's your presiding bishop? Your bishop of your where you're at right now. Your Senate. Do you know it? If you know it, just kind of raise your hand. Okay, how many know two bishops back? Three bishops back. So you know, suddenly with something's going on here. What is it? When I do this with my students in class, my Catholic students go, you know, folks. Benedict, you know, who's that? Well, the second element of that von Hugel wants to talk about is he says every religious tradition that's valid, he thinks there's a few that aren't, but he says are based on not only do you organize yourself around a particular structure or traditional values, but you also have essential doctrinal elements. So these are teachings that would help you understand the world. And so, for example, then I'll ask my Catholic students, tell me what's the basic tenets of the Catholic Church. Huh. And they're horrified. You know, it's huge. You know, you can't just talk about that. I say, but Lutherans, what's the basic tenet? One sentence, maybe three words. What's the basic tenet? One word. Right? And so von Hugel said, you'll note that some institutions, some religious bodies have a tendency towards emphasizing one over or the other. Lutherans and Protestants tend to emphasize doctrine. Organizational, congregations have a lot more autonomy. But in the Catholic Church, you tend to emphasize institutional structure. The Pope, the Archbishop, the Bishops' Conference, and those sorts of things. And so even some of the main decisions about how we will act or what we will believe, I don't know, in North Dakota we recently had an election in which one of the measures was on question of freedom of religion. And it was voted down. It was the issue was that the Constitution doesn't go far enough to protect religious freedoms of people, because it says if they do something that's illegal, you know, and it's still part of their religious tradition, you know, they wanted to open up that bag of worms, and we just, wow, that was scary stuff. But in any case, we have institution, we have doctrine. And so we organize ourselves towards one or the other, but we need both. Well, von Hugo says, really, something that we haven't thought about. Now, this is in the 20th century. We haven't thought about the fact that there's a third element that's important. And we're going to call that the mystical. And I know that when I use the term mystical, that some of you start thinking Harry Potter and the dark arts classes that he used to have or something like that. Mystical is a word that I'd like to reclaim a little bit because it has a negative connotation a lot of times. Sometimes you think of tarot cards, you think of mystical being you know, whatever you might conjure, but I bet you all have some sort of an idea along those lines. Well, for von Hugel, he said, mystical is really what he would want to say as experiential. If doctrine would be intellectual, and this, you could even say this is, you know, tradition or historical. Okay, so von Hugel says, what happens sometimes if you overemphasize the institutional nature of a religious tradition, you start saying things like, unless you're Roman Catholic, you can't get to heaven. Unless you're Lutheran, you can't get to heaven. Or if you're Baptist, or something along those lines. And the same thing can happen with the doctrinal element. Unless you believe the four spiritual laws, unless you believe you're saved by grace, you can't get to heaven. These become ways of dividing yourself from other groups, ways of, and Hugel will even argue at one point, even justifying violent action towards somebody else, as opposed to showing compassion. Now, there's this mystical element within the traditions, and we'll focus on Christianity, which is always manifest in those members of a particular religious group who emphasize not the institution, not the doctrine so much, but the relationship that the individual has to the divine, to the neighbor, to oneself, and to the enemy. And the important thing that the mystical person will have is this idea that love is the thing that binds us together. And it will supersede the institution and the doctrinal teachings, even though those are important. Those are ways we organize and think about ourselves. But von Hugel says the mystic within the tradition usually is the one who gets in trouble. Let's give an example. I'll give modern examples, and I'll start with modern, and I'll move backwards. Martin Luther King Jr. comes along in the 1960s, and a lot of you remember him, right? Some of you are too young, but a number of us remember him. But do you remember the dialogue that was around Martin Luther King Jr.? He comes out, he's speaking about relationships. He's saying, we're going to use nonviolence. We want to raise these issues and get the things on the table that are important to us. That means the dignity of humanity, and let's do that. But do you remember? I remember as a kid, when I was in school, I had friends who said, yeah, he's a communist. Do you remember that? Anybody remember that? Yeah. They also said, well, yeah, and it was a way of dismissing him, right? A way of dismissing him. Say, oh, he's a communist. He's not somebody that we should listen to. He's not about traditional American values, or he doesn't think the way we do. And so he became a problem for the broader traditions, especially some churches in the South, but also churches everywhere. In the North, my church, I don't think, was particularly sensitive to him. So, and so what happens to a lot of mystics? They often wind up dead. they die for their cause. Not always, but, and I'm going to try to expand the definition the way Hugo did as well, but what happens is they become a thorn in the side of the institution because they say, it doesn't matter whether you belong to that group or not, it matters whether you're in a good relationship with the divine and whether you love people. And whether you love your enemy or love yourself. And it doesn't matter how you think so much as that brings you into a loving relationship with the other. Well, von Hugel said this is part of the terrible mystery, right? The question of how we as religious groups try to figure out how to deal with and talk about ourselves. And I use this as a way of talking because as soon as I get this on the board, my students who want to verbally thrash each other for their differences of opinion suddenly start seeing why they're doing it. Because they can see that some are defending their institution, some are defending their ideas, and then suddenly they realize that their actions don't really match the idea that they ultimately hold to, is that every religious tradition is about compassion, right? It's about being in an experience, in a relationship with the divine. The people of Israel, their entire history is a question of who is God and how are we in relationship to him? How do we worship God? So, now the word mystical or mysticism or those sorts of things, I want to just do a little bit with that. First of all, it translates best as mystery or wonder, but it can have this terrible side. The quote I read to you during the mindful moment, can you, O Job, fathom the mysteries of God? And remember, Job, you know, has this great long dialogue with his friends, like Fred said earlier, who just want to yell at him. He has this dialogue with them, and then he questions God. And when he finally gets his answer from the whirlwind, God says, what is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That's the first thing you hear from God. You know, boom, the mystery, the terrible mystery is there. Gird up your loins like a man. How do you translate that? For like, pull on your underwear real tight? Or I don't know. What?
Put on your jockstrap.
Put on your jockstrap. Pull on your jockstrap and I will question you. We'll see who's exposed in this conversation. Where were you when I laid the foundations of this earth? Tell me if you have any understanding. The terrible mystery before Job. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know, God with irony. Who laid the cornerstones of this universe when the morning stars sang together and all of heaven's beings shouted for joy? And Job has no answer. The terrible mystery before him. We don't have the word mystical in the Bible necessarily. We do have the word mystery. It comes up a few times. Like Paul says, we are stewards of the mystery of God. It's a powerful, that's 1 Corinthians 4. You're stewards of the mystery of God and you are required to be trustworthy. Well, what does that mean? The word in the Greek means, in its origins, means to have your eyes shut. And it also suggests that there's a different kind of looking, a different way of seeing the world. Early on in the Christian tradition, and even in the Jewish tradition, Philo of Alexandria, a Jewish scholar, says that mystical was the way you understood the word. And so when we talk about wonder, I'm going to talk about a couple things. One is the wonder of the word, and the other is the wonder of the world. And I'll unpack that more throughout the week, but the wonder of the word is one way we come to know the terrible mystery is through the revelation of these scriptures and how we understand the divine through that. The word mystery, when it was in the Greek, mysterion, was translated into the Latin as sacramentum. And so the word sacrament is a word that's tied to mystery. The word mysterium also could be translated as ministerium, or ministers. Ministers are people who work with the mystery of the divine. And it's also the word Meister, or master, comes off of this word. So what is this mystical tradition? I kind of like the way the Orthodox Church looks at this a little bit. The Orthodox Church says, if you look at God and the mystery of God, it's best to think about God in two ways, both as essence and as energy. As essence, God in God's essence is God in God's being. And that is great mystery. How do we understand God? We can't. We're humans. We're limited, right? We have no ability to grasp the essence of God. But the energy of God, or the work of God in the world, that we can see, that can create wonder. But we can see it only in kind of an indirect way. But what should that do to us? Von Hugel says it should move us within our traditions, within our institutions, within our teachings, to be in that relationship with the divine that is loving, compassionate towards self, neighbor, and enemy. And in the Western tradition, we also get this interesting problem. Well, if I want to be in the relationship with God, how do I do that? How do I enter into the mystery? And there's two really bizarre words that have come up to be used in this way. One is cataphatic. You can do it in a cataphatic way. And that means that you do something. You confess your sins to God, and you acknowledge your own inadequacies, and that moves you through humility into a place of being close to the divine. So cataphatic, or you can go show good works to your neighbor, love the poor, take care of the hungry, or maybe engage just going out into nature. I think the vision, one of the great visions of Holden, is that it moves us. Well, notice that I'm going to say that there are these places in the world in which the world, in which the mystery comes to us. And one of those is through nature. And so we can be active in the process, but we know that always that cataphatic way, that active way of trying to get into the mystery of God, doesn't really work very well. And so there's this great tradition within the Christian church called the apophatic. And the apophatic way is the negative way. One is the positive way, and the other one's the negative way. And the negative way is to say, I know that I am nothing in the presence of the divine. Right? When you come before the divine, when you've been questioning God all your life, like Job, and then God comes in a whirlwind and says, who are you? And you go, I am nobody. Like the Psalms. I am a worm and no man. Psalm 22, right? The mystery is before us. So, what does the mystical tradition do? Well, first of all, the mystical tradition, I think, does two things. It understands, and this is a Celtic notion from Celtic spirituality, it finds thin places. The thin places of the world are those places where you feel close to God. And one of those thin places is, for example, nature. And that's the topic of my talk for tomorrow. How is nature a thin place? Since I'm going to talk about these first four, I think there's 10 places in the world, that 10 ways that I know of right now. There's probably some more yet, but I most of them collapse into these. 10 ways that there are thin places in the world where we encounter the mystery a little bit more easily than others. First of all, we encounter it in the world, and then secondly, in the Word. So through nature, community, suffering, and joy, but also intimacy. And what I mean here, and I wasn't sure of the age of my audience, so I was using the word intimacy, but I mean that what I mean here is really an erotic relationship with another human being. They're that deep intimacy that you have. I think we can have imagination can be a thin place. Study can be a thin place. Mindfulness, by that I mean kind of take the practice of mindfulness, and which we did a little bit at the beginning. Silence and death. Let me explain how that works. When you enter into these thin places, I think the second notion comes in mind, and this is my own kind of thought, but I base it on Celtic thought, is that time becomes thick. So there are thin places in which time becomes thick, or you have thick time. And now I think it's best if I use a few examples. In 2002, this is my last sabbatical. I'm on sabbatical this year, and I'm working on a book on Lutheran prayer. It's my background. I've written a couple books on the history of prayer. And when I was working on my last book, my father became ill with cancer. And my sister called me, and she said, "He's not going to make it. You better get out here." You know. And I'd been, thankfully, since I'd been on sabbatical, I went to be with him in the last moments of his long journey through cancer. And I'm a great thing about thick moments and thin time is that they come back in waves. So I have to focus for a second. They come back as real as the moment they were there. You'll know, you'll have your own examples. But I remember walking into the room, and my father was just slipping into a coma. And I put my hand on his head, and I prayed with him, and he cried. So he knew I was there. Now, I can remember everything about that moment. I can see the room. Time stopped, right? And it became a thin place because I experienced the divine in my father's death. And sometimes the experience of the divine in the moment of death is so profound that it causes questions. I feel like Job. Why? You know? Why? And I don't have any answers. And God comes and stands before me in death. And the experience of the divine is a terrible mystery. It's both beauty and it's also sometimes impossible to describe. So now, if I ask you to think for a moment, can you think of a moment like that in your own life where you're on that thin edge of that place where you're close to the divine, but you're also in that thick moment where time seems to literally stop? It becomes the eternal, what Augustine said, the eternal present. And that's what mindfulness is really about as well. It's trying to learn to live in the present in a way in which you don't allow all those technological and other distractions to crowd out that thing which is important to you. And that's one of the great problems of the mystical tradition. Because the mystical tradition comes along and it says to the institution, you get so caught up in keeping the institution going and you get so caught up in being right that you forget to be in the moment loving and compassionate to those who need it the most, including yourself. And now, just a couple quick qualifications. First of all, the mystical tradition can never be an element by itself. If it becomes an element unto itself, a person going off and I'm going to be close to God, just me and God, you know, out in the wilderness, just, you know, and that's it. It doesn't work. For Hugel, he said, you're always within the rest of the tradition. In fact, you need to be a part of that tradition to call it back to what its true heart should be. And so that's why you need the mystical to come back. But when you do that, the institution doesn't really like that very much. And so you become a problem to the institution. And you have to find that compassionate way to be, so you don't become that mean person and now suddenly start saying you have to be like me in order to get to heaven. Well, again, that becomes the problem, right? That's what the mystics try to fight. But it's always a part of the tradition, it's always a part of the whole. And let me just stop for there. I've been going on for a little bit. Let me see if there's any questions so far. I want to see if that's clear and where we're going, and a few other things I can wrap up with. But let's just pause. Yeah.
Well, my question is about time. And it's about kind of getting to thick time. And it makes me wonder if there's some way in which the mystic also needs the institution. Like to stay with community, for example. those moments of ecstasy and connection and unity with the community, they happen, but rarely in my experience.
Exactly.
And they happen with unexpected people, people that I've not been immediately drawn to. But then something happens that pulls you together at 10.
Well, I think that when I was talking about kind of the positive and negative way, the cataphatic and apathetic way, the positive way, it goes out and tries to manufacture it, and that doesn't work very well. It can happen. Usually, the notion of this thick time and thin place happens spontaneously, usually. It happens outside of your control, and it's not something you can manufacture easily. And so your point is well taken. A lot of times we try to manufacture it, or we try to say, well, just if you just go to church every Sunday, then you'll be okay. Or if you just believe the way we do and come to our Bible studies, you'll be okay. But there's this other greater moment where all of you and I, there's a book by Thomas Hardy called The Spiritual Nature of Man. It was written back in the 1980s, so the title doesn't reflect kind of more modern sensitivities. But in there he did this study, a psychological study of people, and he went around and asked the question, have you ever had these thin, what I call thin place, thick time moments? Have you ever had these things? And everybody said yes. And almost everybody could find one, especially in their youth, in nature. Some moment when you're going along and you're looking at the sunset, I had this experience, I was just talking with somebody the other day in Fargo. They said that they're doing, they have a student staying with them from New York City. And the student lives in a pretty rough part of New York City. And the student came, and one night, it was a really beautiful night, and they said, oh, we're going to go out on the porch and watch the sunset. And the student, this person from New York City went out there, and I couldn't believe the North Dakota sunset. And she was lost in that thin moment, that thick time. And they were, of course, you know, the North Dakotans, this is all ordinary, right? You know, you just do this all, every night if it's nice. And they said, why is that? And she says, I've never seen anything so beautiful in my life. So simple. It overwhelms you. It's like a laugh. That moment when you laugh at something spontaneously, and then all of a sudden it's gone. The moment you realize that you're in it, it's gone. Right? You really can't control that sort of mystical moment. But these moments are moments in which we feel closer connected to God, but also closer connected to everyone else. And even the world. But I'm going to spend my time on that tomorrow. But really, it's also the world, right? You become close, and so you suddenly feel like you want to take care of the world as well as other people.
Isn't it just discovering simple truths?
Oh, this washes away all those busy things of life and says, those things don't matter. And that's why it's also hard, because every day we live, we're bombarded by saying, we matter. You need that Lexus. You need that new smartphone. I know you just got one 2 months ago, but this one's got 4G, and that one only has, you know. And it's almost obscene the way we run through all these things in our lives. And to be honest, I got my first iPad. I thought that was the coolest thing, you know. And it mimics the joy that you really find elsewhere. It's fake. It does mimic it. But that's why we like it. On Friday, I'm going to talk about joy and unpack that a lot, especially through C.S. Lewis's notion of how that works in our lives. But so there's a lot more to be said here, but yeah.
In his memoir, Eugene Peterson cites von Hugel as one of his intellectual lodestones, and which is interesting, I think, because his whole project in translating the Bible into contemporary language is, I think, bring the historical and intellectual into an experiential, because he wants this contemporary language to be this kind of immediacy. So it seems that he's kind of a contemporary example of what that might mean.
Perfect example of that. And I see a lot of times when I get, as when I was chair of the department, especially a lot of the news, the editor of the religion page at the Fargo Forum was a former student, and they would often interview me. And I would say, you know, in the year 2000, I was asked, well, what's going to be the issue for the next century? I said, well, let's go back 100 years. And what was the issue in 1900? What could they not have imagined in the year 2000? Women pastors? Oh, my goodness. You know, impossible, right? You know, and a lot of things. And I said, I thought that the issue for us would be the issue in the Lutheran Church would be the issue of homosexuality. And I said it would come, with, I thought, within about 10 years. I was just guessing at that time. So I said, about 10 years. And then they said, well, why is that? I said, because what we see mirrored in our society is people experiencing, getting to know, not homosexuals, but getting to know Gary or Leslie or whoever it is. The experience of the person creates compassion. Right? Does that make sense? And as long as you can keep it as an idea, homosexuality is bad, and it's an idea, then you can exclude them, right? And it justifies being harsh or cruel. And the experiential moves us to a completely different place, you know, and getting to know people. But this is a difficult problem for us, right? Still remains a problem. But as our society wrestles with this, as our church wrestles with this, we know instinctively that the mystical tradition, that's what Hugo would say, we know instinctively that this is where we want to be anyway. We want to be in a compassionate, loving relationship with the divine. The question is how do we do it? And Paul's point is really well taken. We can't really manufacture it very well. That's why Holden, I think, is one of these great places. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow with nature. I think that's really is really essential because of what it does. It has transformative power. By its place and what it does, it is a thin place, thick time place. But give you some. Augustine said very simply, he says, remember I said the origins of the word mystical come from the idea of keeping your eyes shut. It implies the idea that you look inward. And Augustine said, we really need three types of vision. First of all, like if I write the words, love your neighbor, on the board. Okay? Augustine says, I have bodily eyes that see that this guy has somewhat bad penmanship, right? I don't write really well. But you could see the physical words. I see them with my bodily eyes. That's the first type of vision we have. It's just physical. But secondly, we have what he calls spiritual vision. And so when I write, love your neighbor, Augustine says the second type of spiritual vision that you need is you need to visualize the neighbor. So I see you in that word, neighbor. What's your name?
Beth.
So Beth is my neighbor, and now I've transformed that physical word into a real reality. So Beth is my neighbor. That's what Augustine says. So you have different ways of seeing. Now that I know Beth and see her in this world, I have a different way of understanding than just some sort of physical reality that fits into an institutional or doctrinal idea. And then there's also a third way, says Augustine. For Augustine, the word intellectus or intellectual way of seeing was kind of there was spiritual and intellectual. And in the intellectual is kind of where you move into the mystery. So you have the physical, the spiritual, and then the intellectual, and the mystery of it. And the mystery is in the word love. And it's the love that flows between Beth and I, or my enemy and I, or the nature, the world and I, God and I, whatever. But whatever that relationship is, I haven't met Beth, I'd ask her name, right? But if I look at my wife, the loving relationship that I have with her is pretty mystically complicated, right? When my wife and I first fell in love, We were at Pacific Lutheran University. I remember very, very clearly. Took her out to, I remember the moment I fell in love with her. We went out to Eagle Point State Park. We had a picnic, and it was really wonderful. And she was wearing a bandana and a white shirt with jeans. And
this was all
jeans. And I remember it just kind of blurted out, you know, I said, I love you. And
this is the first date.
And she didn't say anything. And it took her a while before she had the moment of that same sort of feeling. And I kind of was in, all of a sudden, I was in that moment. I was lost, thick time, you know, thin place. And then I was out of it pretty quick because I got no response. I was kind of like, okay, time to get in the car. I think I've got a big religion test tomorrow morning, or something like that. But the point of it is that that moment, it is complete mystery. I can't really explain to you the love that I have for my wife. It's just mystery. And for me, a lot of it is this being... The other way I could describe what the mystics are trying to get at is what Teresa of Avila said. It's your soul being lost in another. You know, you're lost in the moment. That moment of love is when you're so in love that you really care. You're really lost in the other in a way that you care for that person in a way that you want all of their happiness, whether it's God, whether it's nature, whether it's your enemy. I'll tell you one story. How much time do I have? I have till 12, right?
Yep.
Okay. I have to tell one story of a transformative... I may not be able to get through this one either. It's too powerful. My son's a documentary filmmaker. He said, Dad, I want to make a movie about Muhammad Iqbal, the founder of the modern Pakistani state. He was a Sufi poet and mystic. And he said, I need somebody with me in Pakistan. We're going to go for a month. And I went. Because my son is in Egypt right now. During the elections, he's making a documentary about that. He always makes me nervous wherever he goes. But so we went to Pakistan. And I was just basically the guy with the white beard that drank 3 cups of tea while they filmed. Because I would talk with the elders and things, and they thought I was really important, and I had no clue what we were doing. And so one day we went to Wazir Khan Mosque in Lahore, and it is an incredibly beautiful mosque in the midst of incredible poverty. And we walked through the streets, and my son and his film crew are almost shocked into disbelief at what they're seeing. And we made it to the mosque, and they decided that they were going to film in the minarets as this public square of about 5,000 people is going to fill up. And so I'm standing in the back of the square thinking, that's great. And then I'm thinking, this is Jummah prayers, Friday afternoon. There's going to be 5,000 people here in this. And I'm the only white Christian guy that's sitting here. And suddenly, I had this moment of fear. It was a definite fear. The week before we left, the Newsweek magazine came to our house. It said, Pakistan, the most dangerous place in the world. My wife says, you're not going. I said, well, I'm not sending our son alone. So, so I'm going to go, and we'll both die. So you know, and it was this sort of terrible fear. And all of a sudden, these people are streaming in. And I realize I have nowhere to go. I have nowhere to hide. I am the other. One of the most profound experiences I've ever had of being the other as these Muslims are coming in. And a man, probably 5 foot, stretching it, he was a very short, wizened. It's hard to tell how old Pakistanis are because they die, average age is in their 50s. But he looked like he was well into his 80s. And he came over to me and he said, brother, would you welcome to our mosque? And I said, thank you. I'm in the back of my head, I said, I'm just trying to hide. I'm just back here. I'm okay, you know. He said, would you like to pray with us? And I said, well, I'm a Christian and my son is in the film crew. You can see his camera up there. And I'm actually a Lutheran pastor, you know, no understanding of that. And he says, well, that doesn't matter, brother. He says, would you come pray with me? And I said, sure, you know, well, let's pray. And he said, well, we need to wash. And I said, I have no clue on how Muslim ritual washing goes, you know. So he takes me through the process, and we go into the middle of this crowd, and we do prayers. And as I stood up, I was in the middle of this crowd. I was in the midst of 5,000 Muslims in Pakistan. And he said, brother, I want you to wait here. And he went, and he was a teacher, and he got his students. They were all scattered around the place, and he brought them all over, and he said, I want you to meet this American. He's a Christian. We were praying together today. And the students were asking all sorts of questions. Some of them were kind of touching me, you know, like, you know, oh, wow, I've never met an American before, you know. It was one of the most beautiful, profound religious experiences I've ever had, and it transformed my view of the other because I had become the other. It's like when you come into contact with the other becomes a mirror by which you see yourself more clearly. And the way by which you can understand that God is in this individual.
It's like meeting Gary rather than the homosexual guy.
Exactly. His name's Muhammad. And every time there's a bombing in Lahore, I worry about it. You know, that's exactly right. He became not a Muslim, he became Muhammad. He became the person that showed kindness to me in the midst of a very uncomfortable spot. The mystical tradition is about that. The mystical tradition, and I think I've tried to use this as a way for my students in classes to try to be able to dialogue in a more sane and more compassionate way, because I think everybody can ultimately agree with Hugel that this is where we need to develop the faith. In the bookstore, I recommend it. Sometimes they say, you know, bring books or recommend books if some people want to buy it. Another theologian who uses a lot of this idea is Dorothy Zala. Her book, Silent Cry, Mysticism and Resistance, I highly recommend it to you. When I talk about nature tomorrow, I think, Peggy, you have Beauty, a book by John O'Donohue. Those two books are in the bookstore if you want to learn a little bit more about this mystical tradition. But one of the things Dorothy Zala says is what happens in life when you have the mystical experience, you're amazed. And one of the things that we need to do is simply be amazed. We need to allow ourselves the ability to be amazed. And a lot of times we push it away because we're afraid, because we have a different way of organizing our world. So first of all, be amazed. Secondly, let go. What is it that you have been taught in that divine moment through the scriptures or through the experience of oneness? I had to, when I met Muhammad in Pakistan, I had to let go of the idea that these were radical Muslims. Although the media had told me that forever, I found none when I was in Pakistan, although I know they're there. They're in more, so I had to let go of some ideas. And then Zala says, the last thing you must do is you must start to resist. That's why her title is called Mysticism and Resistance. The best element of who we are, says von Hugel, resists the elements of religious traditions which promote hate and cruelty. And that brings us back to the center. Other people who talk about similar ideas, if you want to read, is Karen Armstrong, who's a Center for Compassion, and some of you may well know about, and promoting certain religious things along those lines goes there. 1 minute. One, maybe a final question or comment. Yeah.
What was that last book,
Karen Armstrong? Karen Armstrong, she's got tons of them. If you go online, and I think it's called the Center for Compassion. You can go online and find, they have actually a manifesto that you can sign. It talks about religion supporting compassion, not hatred, and those sorts of things. And she's got a number of books that she's written. She's really an ex-nun who started she's got a lot of books on history, like history of God, history of Islam, a number of things like that. Well, this is the beginning. We'll get more focused on specifics on nature tomorrow, community, suffering, and joy, which is my favorite, on Friday. I thank you for coming today. I usually tell people, since I'm a pastor and a teacher, I have double the ability to put people to sleep, but you were wide awake the whole time, and I really appreciate your willingness to be here and listening. So thanks.